We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands we are recording on today. We pay our respects to the people of the Lachilachi lands and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you're listening from today. A vibrant regional city full of contrast, from the Murray River to the outback, there is something for everyone. So says the Mildura Tourism website. It was here that the first mafia tribunals were held, and it was here that the bloodiest murders took place. But today the town is known for wine, food and tourism, and it's a far cry from Griffith's mafia reputation. I'm Carlo Reglia. Welcome to my Australian Mafia road trip. Anne and I are walking through the centre of Mildura. We walk up and down the main street, trying to understand how the city works, but one thing is immediately clear. The vibe is very different from Griffith's. Restaurants, bars and cafes are filled with people enjoying the late summer evening. Anna tells me that here, mafia crimes manage to go under the radar.
Nothing of the type of the events happening in Griffith ever happened here, even though we have evidence or at least information related to murders, to violence. So this area was particularly connected to even, perception of mafia violence and involvement with drugs. We saw that is very well connected to the marijuana plantation in the period of the grass castles. There were grass castles even here.
If you don't know what a grass castle is, imagine your classic Australian McMansion, an extraordinarily large house, multiple stories high, several car garages, actually like a castle, and paid for, you guess it, with grass. As funny as it sounds today, in the 70s, being accused of having a grass castle was a serious slur in the Italian community. But despite all the drug trade, the crime and the murders, Mildura did not capture the dark imagination of 1970s Australia the way Griffith had done.
There never was the original sin, and a step too far for the mafia groups, which obviously we're referring to the Donald McKay affair, and also the complete, let's say, failure from law enforcement at the time to recognize, to go through with the things that were emerging. So I think in that sense, Mildura 'Ndrangheta was able to change without too many eyes on them. And it did change, sometimes moving away of Mildura, moving into Melbourne, or some members moved into Canberra, or even Adelaide. And it changed from within without much scrutiny.
And let's be honest, the murders at the time, the 60s and 70s, were within the organisation.
Yes, it was obviously the case that the moment in which you had these Italians killing each other, the alarm wasn't as much as it would be today, or as it would have been if they were an Italian. So clearly that played a role in the way these things were investigated. They were still investigated, I must say, but there is also this clear indication in the documents, in the early documents, that the police often found walls of silence, and no one talks to us, so we might as well drop this kind of thing. So they found very difficult to interact with the community.
In the 1980s, several murders shook the region, including that of Marco Medici, a member of a well-known local family. And after that, that of Dominic Marafiote and his parents. These killings were often gruesome in their violence, sending a clear message to other families. These crimes usually remained unsolved. The police had a poor relationship with the Italian community. There were language barriers and cultural misunderstanding. Even though Mildura has had a large Italian immigrant population since the 50s, life was not always easy for them. At first, they were called wogs, and later, they were called mafiosi. Local Italian-Australian artist Lucy Calipari remembers it well. Lucy has lived in Mildura her whole life. Her parents were first-generation migrants from Calabria.
In primary school, you know, someone called me a wog. So, an Australian boy, you know, called me a wog, which, you know, I wasn't too fazed about. And I think it just came from ignorance, you know, that inherited ignorance that you're different, so therefore we will single you out and call you whatever. But, you know, I stood up for myself because my mother always taught me to stand up to bullies. So, you know, basically I told them where to go and they ended up being my friends.
If being called a wog was common in those days, being accused of being part of the mafia, because they were Calabrian, was another level of insult. Lucy experienced that shame in the classroom.
When I was in secondary school and I was in either year 7 or year 8, and a teacher, you know, openly expressed his displeasure with Italians and Calabrians especially, you know, basically it was, you know, in front of a room full of classmates, you know, accused them of being dishonest people and, you know, getting up to all sorts of things and, you know, basically mafiosi. And that, you know, I challenged him and he didn't take kindly to that, so my grades suffered. You know, I remember going home and telling my mum, just like, you know, mum and dad, and they're like, oh, you know, don't worry about it. But of course they were outraged, and I wasn't the only Italian in that class, but, you know, I was the only one that kind of pushed back.
Hostility in the community and strong stereotypes were reflected not only in the local population, but also in the police. They were confusing mafia crimes like honor killings as Calabrian cultural practices. I asked Anna about the misunderstandings between the police and the Italians.
Absolutely, there was a lot of that, where they assumed that everything that they saw, they mistook for mafia culture. So that essentially meant that if they saw an honor killing, for them it was a Calabrian way of behaving and not a mafia way of behaving. And there was, you know, there were problems associated to that. But there were also problems associated to the fact that people in the community instinctively know who they need to guard themselves from, and especially, you know, everyone knows who are the important people, who we would define as mafia bosses or mafia heads at the time. And if you see that the police is not doing anything to protect you from those people that are instead actually quite well established in the community, and it is not exactly, you know, brilliant. So, yeah, so that's probably also fueled the silence wall that the authorities encountered, especially at the beginning.
If everything came to a halt in Griffith after McKay's disappearance, mafia killings in Mildura continued for several years.
Mildura had a different evolution from Griffith. Griffith had a very abrupt stop to an awful lot of things because they had to stop because of all the media attention that followed the McKay murder and the Royal Commission. Mildura had a different evolution. And so you have murders up until the 90s, actually.
Because after all the media interest and police interest after the Don McKay murder, the bosses and lots of people involved actually moved out.
This shows actually one of the main characteristics of the 'Ndrangheta, not just in Australia, overall, which is linked to the fact that there is no one boss. So even if one group, one clan goes down or has to go down, has to, you know, reduce the activity, a bit like communicating vessels, you will see someone else growing somewhere else. And it might not be directly connected, you might not be able to understand how this is connected, but at some point something will confirm that it is connected. And what happened between in this area, in Mildura, was very much an indirect effect of these communicating vessels, connected vessels, experiment. So you push down Griffith, different things emerge in Melbourne, in Sydney, and in Mildura for sure.
Our walk takes us to the bend in the Murray River, where the famous paddle steamers leave for sightseeing tours. We stop at a bar close by. Mixed in with the tourists, it's hard to remember that, according to an ASIO report, 'Ndrangheta presence in Mildura dates back to the mid-1960s. The sometimes tense relationship between the community and authorities made the police slow to react. But also, victims of the mafia did not always realize they were victims. To make this point, just before ordering a beer, Anna gives me a short lesson in extortion.
Mildura was very well known at the beginning because a number of leaders of the 'Ndrangheta were running an extortion ring of the grapes growers or apparently anyone involved in the fruit and vegetable market so that they could essentially create a cartel of prices in the supply chain from Mildura into Melbourne, into the fruit and vegetable market in the Queen Victoria market in Melbourne. So what some of the things that happened, some were very obvious. So you ask people for money. So classic extortion. So give me £200 for protection.
And there are no doubts with that.
And there are, I think some people might have expected to pay for protection rackets, as in, I don't feel safe. I need protection. Therefore, I pay for protection as a service. But in other cases, the extortion racket was a little bit less obvious and it was a bit more like a request for a contribution to the society. So it was not linked necessarily to the business. It was linked to we need to stick together. The Australians are not extremely friendly with us. We are in a foreign land. We need to work together and create, some sort of mutual aid collective. And this mutual aid collective, like you very much would do if you belong to a club today, you pay for a fee, and this should become a contribution for events or, other services. It wasn't quite clear what these were. And obviously this was another form of, getting certain people...
A slightly more subtle way to ask for money,
yes.
A fee.
Yeah, but this also explains why most people might not have realized that they were being extorted. Also, because don't forget that some people unfortunately had their experience back home already. And so it's very difficult to figure out. And it's actually, if I might dare say that, it is a bit more understandable as well here. Arrive again in a new country, you seek points of reference, and the points of reference are also linked to your sense of safety and belonging, and mafias provide that sense of safety and belonging with a cost, with a hidden cost, always. But the hidden cost might not become obvious until it's too late. But I think there is a very powerful myth of the good mafia, of the good onorata società, that was very much alive in 1940s, 1950s in those areas in Calabria and became very much alive here because the men who arrived here with that idea brought it with them.
The mafioso of the 1950s and 60s then presents himself not as a criminal, but as a provider of services denied to the immigrants in Australia.
That's the way they put themselves out in the community, not as parasite of the community, but as very much involved in the community and promoting this idea of doing the best interest of the community and providing something that the community needed, which was safety and cohesion. It's not that obvious for many people that these people were committing any crime. So you are not willingly protecting criminals. You are compromising to a certain way, and social psychology says that every one of us has different threshold of tolerability. There are things that might be okay for you that are not okay for me, and we learn from each other in the same community what these are. We negotiate constantly, but it's not that obvious that my line, my threshold is the same as yours. So I might consider okay to pay for my security if I don't feel that those who are deputed to give me security are not doing their job. You might not think that that's a good thing to do, but I might. And I think this negotiation is eventually where the manipulation goes.
Even in an Australian context?
Absolutely, especially in an Australian context where the community is much smaller and much more vulnerable. At that time, obviously, we're talking about a time of arrivals and a time of extreme difficulty of integration and work and, assimilation to what was a very different society.
The circumstances that led to the belief in the good mafia, according to Anna, are no longer possible in today's Australia.
The kind of behaviours you had at that time would not be possible today because there is a lot more. So you wouldn't find the type of extortion that we used to have. You wouldn't find the type of, manipulation. You find other things, and we can discuss about other things, but eventually you don't find that kind of behavior because the community evolved.
I am ready for my beer, but Anna's extortion lesson is not over yet. We talked earlier about some of the ways the mafia indirectly demand money. Another way they do this is by creating artificial bottlenecks in supply chains. And this is next to impossible for an ordinary person to even see.
If you have a business and you need to bring your product from point A to point B, you need to do a number of steps, including, you know, managing logistics, managing licensing, a number of different things, depending on what is your product. And if some of the families, the criminal families, or the families with criminals in it, control one of these steps, where, you know, you have to go through them because there is no one else. So in a quasi-monopolistic environment, which eventually means discouraging competitors from entering the market, that would be something that the persons who have to do those steps and, you know, refer to them to do it because they are the only ones who provide a specific service would not understand this as extortion because, you know, they have to do it anyway. They have to go through the various steps of the supply chain.
As in, like, there's only this guy to transport to, my
fruit. So I'm going to go with that. The prices will not be extortionate. The prices will be pretty much, you know, affordable, of course, because they can keep the competition down, out, really. And that would not be perceived as neither illegal nor problematic, you know. Is the formation of cartels around certain businesses as well, that again would not be perceived as violent imposition. They would be perceived as something is not quite right here, but hey, whatever.
The key word to understanding the mafia is ambiguity. It's a world where you can be subjected to extortion practices without even realizing it. It's a world of subtleties, where even common actions can hide different meanings. This becomes even more obvious the next day. We've packed up the car and are about to head off from Mildura. Before making the long drive back to Melbourne, we drop into a cafe, and here Anna teaches me about the hidden meanings behind a cup of coffee in Calabria.
Hi, what can I get you today?
Can I get a macchiato and a cappuccino?
Cappuccino for me, thanks.
Yes.
Anything else today?
Not for me, no.
No worries, just $9.40.
Thank you.
Starting a new day with a coffee. Well, yes. classic Italian style. Well,
yes.
Also Australian style. But there's a story that I want you to tell me, because apparently a coffee is not a coffee in Calabria.
Not always.
Here a coffee is a coffee, but in Calabria a coffee is not always a coffee. How's that?
Well, there is a convention, you know, a norm that most of the time happens in some small places, small areas. Basically, you order a coffee at the bar, as we do in Italy, sometimes standing, right? And then you go and pay for the coffee, and the coffee has been paid for. And so you ask, who paid, right? And if you know that person, usually the cashier will tell you, you know, it was that man over there, and that's all fine. But sometimes you basically leave the bar without knowing who paid. Sometimes you can have a coffee paid by someone that you can identify as having ulterior motives. See, I'm a nice person. I even paid you coffee. You will owe me in the future.
So even for just a little thing,
yes,
as
because
a coffee.
It's not just the value of the coffee. It's not just the €1 of the coffee. It's more about a social debt. It's like a debt of gratitude. So you will have to recognize in the future that I did the gesture for you, and therefore,
so you could, just let me get this straight. You can get a coffee from someone you don't know, mm-hmm. and if you accept it, it means that you owe this man or this woman a debt of gratitude.
There is no problem of accepting it. That's the whole point. It's already been paid, so there is no turning it back. So you go and pay, and the cashier said it's been paid for. And so it's not like you can say, oh, no, I want to pay anyway. You have to accept it. That's the whole point.
What are the consequences of this?
There are no immediate consequences. It's just, you know, it usually means someone has recognized you as being, you know, somehow a part of that environment. So maybe because you are from there and you haven't gone back for years, but they still recognize you, or because they recognize or they know your relatives. So it's a gesture, you know, it's a gesture of recognition. but it's also a gesture of reciprocation. So it creates an expectation of reciprocation in the future. It's complicated. Yes, it's I know. Very puzzled.
I'm so confused. Tricky question. Yes. How can you tell good paid coffee from a bad paid coffee?
The good paid coffee usually comes with a clear knowledge of who paid. The person usually goes and pay at the bar and then waves at you from you know, while going away. So you'll know, and you usually recognize each other, and that's a normal gesture of goodwill. Sometimes you have the, you know, coffees paid on over a few days. So you go to the same bar every day, and every day your coffee is always paid, which means that someone has told the bartender that all of your coffees are paid. And, you know, this happened to my father, and he had to change bar.
He had to change bar.
Yeah, because it became very obvious that was a constant reminder that everyone knew that he was going to the bar, and that the person who paid was someone my father didn't want to, you know, to receive the kindness from.
Is it a form of social control as well?
It's not just social control. It's more of a, I'm here even when I'm not here. So it is that kind of social control. Yes, I know your habits, I know where you go, and you accept. And at some point, it can become also a, you know, for the person who receives it and who has some doubts on the gesture of goodwill, it can become a moment where if I keep accepting it, I might give wrong impression. I might give the impression that I actually like receiving it. So that's why my father had to change place, because after 1 week of your coffee is paid for, at some point it became very obvious that it wasn't a good gesture, a goodwill gesture, that it was some sort of imposition of, you know, if you keep accepting it, we kind of are coming to an agreement that I'm a good person and you are accepting it. And you don't want this to go around. You don't want this kind of message to go around.
It's so
it's so bizarre. From a coffee.
I think yes. I'm off coffee.
Yes.
A bizarre custom that may never catch on in Australia, given how expensive coffee is. And speaking of coffee, it's time to think about our next stop. We talked about two corners of the Mafia Triangle, Griffith and Mildura. Now it's time to head back to Melbourne, the third corner, and where our road trip began. We're headed to a place that in the 60s was really rough, and a hotbed of mafia activity. It was here that a series of accidents made the Honours Society's name known throughout Australia. We're going to tell you about the Queen Victoria Market murders. My Australian Mafia Road Trip is produced by me, Carlo Reglia, with SBS Italian and SBS Audio. To have episodes delivered directly to your device, follow My Australian Mafia Road Trip on the SBS Audio app, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.